Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our third session today. It's the penultimate session of the day. We have one more after it called Happy Hour. I hope you'll join us for that, too. But I think we might need a happy hour after after talking about managing your museum through hard times. But we have two really positive people with some good information to share and to help us get thinking about it. And then we can all retreat to virtual happy hour after that. Sound good, Tom and Pat?
Sounds great.
Let me just remind people how this is going to work. Over on the left side of your screen, we do encourage you to ask questions of Tom and Pat as we go along, and I'll do my best to share those with them as we go through our session today. We are curious to find out how many people at this point are with you. We know each session sometimes attracts different people at your organization, but would you go ahead? Let me go ahead and have you vote. There you go. If you voted already, go ahead and I've just reset that for you. Let's find out how many of you are in groups right now and how many maybe are logged in on your own. And as we've expected, we have between about almost two-thirds of you, or two-thirds to a half, are in groups. So we hope you will feel free to share those questions and comments that come in from your colleagues with us as we go along as well. That's really very useful for us to know. And don't forget, all of the sessions are being posted on the program page from throughout the conference. So check those out, and we'll be, of course, adding any additional things over the coming days that we may get from presenters during the online conference. But with that, I hope you'll join me in welcoming Tom Costello and Pat Williams, and I'll pass the mic over to Tom first to kick things off. Over to you, Tom.
Well, thank you. And we, Pat and I, are delighted to be here with you this afternoon. We're talking about managing your museum in hard times, or through hard times, or getting beyond hard times. And we are eager to share our experiences and had the good fortune of doing this session this morning live here, so we may have some other things to share from that. I have been working in the museum field for 30 years in museums of all kinds, art, history, science, a zoo, on the staff of each of these, not in a consulting capacity. And I've worked in performing arts as well as for several years in higher education. So bring to the experience of sharing with you some of the things that I've learned, and particularly an experience about 20 years ago when I was president of the Springfield, Massachusetts Library and Museums Association, where we had to go through exactly what many of you are going through today at a magnitude that was startling to us. And that resulted in over 13 months eliminating 100 positions out of 300 because of public funding cuts. So Pat, I'll let speak for you, for yourself.
Right. I spent the majority of my time in my career work at the national level, working first for the National Trust for Historic Preservation, second for the American Association of Museums, both as a director of accreditation and vice president for policy and programs. And most recently, spent 7 years at Americans for the Arts, primarily as chief operating officer. So I've had personal experiences in both the National Trust and Americans for the Arts with downsizing, if you will, right-sizing, whatever the phrase of the moment is. I'm also currently the chairman of the board of the Accokeek Foundation. This is an operating foundation in the southern part of Prince George's County, which strives to protect Mount Vernon's overlook so that what you see from the porch that Washington stood on in his time is what you see today. We are inside a national park. We are a cooperating agency with the National Park Service. We receive a federal appropriation, which makes up 80% of our budget. We raise the rest of the dollars. And we have recently gone through, in this capacity, substantial contingency planning. We have not had to take action on that broader part of the contingency plan, though we have put in place a 5% reduction overall in our 2009 budget, and we've used our contingency plan to develop budget guidelines for 2010. So I can speak from this from past experience as well as currently on the ground with an outdoor living history museum.
Thanks, Pat. We are going to be looking at our schedule here with really three components, not perfectly divided, but we'll be reacting talking about reacting to your museum situation, then making changes, and then growing and developing in different ways. A key theme that we have, and we'll be coming back to again and again through our conversation with you, is the idea that we are promoting and encouraging that you think about cutting through the organization, not cutting back. And we'll talk about the meaning of that, except that we think it is a very important distinction that will help you as you think and rethink again your institutions or organizations in the weeks and months to come. Love to know if maybe you could put the first question up to see what, to help us in understanding. Love to get some information, and one of the questions is, what is your role in your museum? And I'd love it if you could respond so that we'd have a sense of who's listening to us. And I guess you can check in.
Yeah, you know what, Tom? I've just changed the poll because I know we have a lot of groups with us, so there may be executive directors and mid-level staff and volunteers gathered.
Right.
So you can now check off all that apply for the group that's with you, and you can get a feel for who's at this particular session. And the numbers are still coming in, but we have roughly equal parts of executive directors and presidents, senior staff, department heads. We have some of we have mid-level staff with us as well, and we have a sizable percentage, about 20%, who are saying you are other. Could you let us know what we've missed so we know as well? Go ahead and put that in the chat box on the left, and we'll start to get a feel for your particular role. And I should also mention, Tom, that I know you did this poll earlier today.
Yes.
And we have a little bit of a breakdown, a little picture of you showing what that breakdown was from this morning, too.
It's very similar, except we didn't have a lot of other. it'll be interesting to see what you are.
Library supervisors. We have some consultants, a marketing consultant who's with us. And others should feel free. Here's some more.
Okay,
history.
So consulting would be a logical place, and we hadn't thought about that.
And educators, museum
and
educators as well.
Which I think of as mid-level staff in an administrative category. But it's good to hear whatever you are dealing with, because I see Jennifer there in association work as well. So that's great. As you can see, we had from about 25 people, we had fairly similar breakdown for what you're having, a bit more on we have online, as I would imagine it, mid-level staff and senior staff, because you didn't have to travel to get here. And I guess it was your executive director or president who decided they were going to travel here this time. So thank you. And I think the other is, going forward, how much of a reduction in initial funding you have experienced. And when we give these percentages, we're trying to kind of get an order of magnitude, not be exact, but would love to see what kinds of conditions we have out there that we're dealing with, how many of you came in with different levels. We actually had one person this morning who had an increase, and we all crowded around her afterwards to get her ideas. But it's very interesting to see that a fair number of you are actually have no decrease at the present.
Mm-hmm.
And then a fair number of you have 20% or more. And that's why you're not here in Indianapolis and you're online with us, I suspect. This is a big help, and keep filling that in as you can. We'll turn meanwhile to to our next slide and really talk about reacting to the situation. The first step that we believe is absolutely critical is establishing a framework and your principles for crisis decision making. Really important that you establish how you're going to go about doing this and what your own guidelines are. Who is involved, defining the potential levels of change, and first by the numbers, then by mission and vision, at least the first time you go through this. As you will see, this is a reiterative process. We go through this several times because it's not easy to do it. It's not all in one swoop that we can get these things done. But first, to really look at the numbers. What does it mean if we lose 20% of our budget? What in broad terms? And then what are the levels of operation based on funding available? And these don't have to be detailed for every level, as we will discuss, but it's helpful to get at least a sketch.
So I thought it was very important when we set up our contingency planning committee at the Akakik Foundation in February of this year that we had a framework that looked at the numbers but also looked at the various sectors of the operation, our ecosystem farm, our colonial farm, our shares program, our museum theater program, our cooperative ventures, and analyzed our numbers against the impact that losing that program or closing a program down might have on the audiences that we serve. So I wanted to put together a matrix that we analyzed numbers, but also audience impact, and impact on our users. It might be very easy, for example, for us to shut down our ecosystem farm. It's a farm, big fields, a tractor, a senior farmer, and two apprentice farmers. However, when we analyzed it by the numbers, we found out that it actually breaks even, and we have 460 shareholders that if we shut it down, we'd lose their goodwill. So that was why it was important for us, and we think it's important for you, to analyze the impact, not just financially, but on future friends, future funders.
Okay, thanks.
See on this slide, both from Tom's perspective and the Akakik Foundation perspective, who made up our crisis planning and contingency planning teams.
Yes, and we had the, I'd say executive director, I was president, but it's really the same function. And my vice president for finance were the two senior staff people involved in all of the discussions. We also had three board officers, and they happened to be people who were or were going to become president of the board and our treasurer. We also had a labor attorney because in our situation in Springfield, we had a union. That union happened, it was an Ask Me Local, and it actually was in the middle of our organization. It was focusing on the entry-level professional or the professional staff that did not have any direct reports. And so it would be curatorial staff and library staff who were not supervisors. And we needed to make sure that we had been involved, we had them involved through the labor attorney first to be able to understand what the dynamics were. And it's really important to understand how you flow your people through the organization as you reduce staff, because you're not cutting people, you're cutting positions. And then there's an issue of seniority about who stays and who goes, and some people may want to bump somebody out of a lower level position so they stay. And when you have a union in the middle, you have people bouncing off the top of the union. The union might not allow a flow through of people above the union level to come back into the union, because it means that their union members are going to be out of a job. It's much easier for the people who are in the union to flow out of the union to a lower level position that isn't in the union. So it's things to think about if you have an organization that has probably a significant number of employees and a union. It doesn't happen, some of these issues just don't happen when you're dealing with a non-union operation. And then defining the principles that we would be using included things around working with the union. So it was really helpful to us to define knowing what levels we were going to be looking at. First, the known level of reduction, which is what we knew that week in our discussions over a period of weeks. And we had about 5 or 6 weeks to do all the initial adjustments and live with that. It changed the amount that we were looking at in terms of reduction changed from week to week as the city, which is the primary source of our support, even though we were a private nonprofit, that the city gave us revised figures. And then we did beyond that in what I call back of the envelope 25% reduction, 35% reduction, 60% reduction, and even went to the idea of saying, what if we got no public funding? Because the units of operation that we had that were would remain would be the Art Museum, which had an endowment, and one of the branch libraries that had an endowment, but was the least well attended of any of the libraries, library branches. So it would have been an unusual ending point. So, and Pat, you may want to.
We did a similar projection, though we weren't facing any loss of our federal appropriation, which makes up 80% of our budget this year. In fact, we were supposed to have an increase this year. We went ahead and projected loss of 20, 40, and 60%. It was a very helpful exercise, though I must say when we finished it and wrote our report, I cried, because I looked at all the hard work that we had put in, particularly over the last 20 years, of building the organization, building out our education programs, our cooperative agreements with a number of other nonprofits, and saw a number of those things when you get to something like a 60% reduction simply going away.
I want to emphasize at the bottom of this slide creating sketches of funding levels. Below the funding level that you're really having to focus on at this point, just get, again, back of the envelope. Don't spend lots of time getting into detail. But by having these, you really start to get a sense of, we're looking at this as not being a one-year thing. This is a two-year thing, three-year thing, possibly even a four-year thing. In Springfield, at the end of 5 years, we were dealing with these issues again, as there was no increase and or there were shifting in dollars that we had to spend for a variety of reasons. So we really needed to be thinking, we all need to be thinking about, so we did this, what happens next? And getting into this kind of sketch of different levels helps us get there. In planning change then, and what we'll see over the next several slides, is what I described as a reiteration. We go through this, we discover as we develop the budget that we're not anywhere near, and certainly the first time, not anywhere near what we need to cut in order to balance our budget. And we go back through it again, each time looking hard, if you will, a bit harder at the issues. So, and part of this is then, again on the theme of cutting through, not cutting back, what are our strategies for moving forward, defining options in the scope of programmatic change? Because what we have to do is really look at what are we going to do moving ahead, not how are we cutting back, so that we don't leave people isolated or programs isolated without any ability to truly perform. We may need to set them aside for permanently or for a year or two as we focus on those core programs and services that we really do need to have. So that leads us then to redefining what makes our institution good to great, reviewing our mission, prioritizing those institutional goals and programs, and adjusting what your measure of success is. Because if you're closing the library or your museum for 50% of the hours that you had previously, you're not going to have the same kind of attendance. You're not going to have the same measures of success. You need to identify what those should be. And then the other piece is, in cutting through, not cutting back, is the notion of setting aside entire programs rather than just limiting travel or something like that. Not that they wouldn't do that as well. And also listening to your community, its hopes and expectations. And part of that is a continuing dialogue where if you haven't been doing it with your community, this is a really great opportunity to build new relationships with your community.
I think that we experienced in earlier reductions in staff when I was personnel administrator at the National Trust for Historic Preservation, a different approach which was not effective, and that was trimming everywhere, reducing staff across the board. So we left some programs like our Maritime Heritage Program with one staff person. We left our Rural Heritage Program with one staff. Those two programs were actually unable to perform when we trimmed them that far. So this is why we say setting aside entire programs, or finally doing something we always say we're going to do when we do strategic planning, is stop doing some things. And that is, seems to be so hard for us as nonprofits to do that. But this is the time when we really have to make those kinds of decisions. And I think Tom will emphasize a little bit later, really making decisions is what this is about.
So, one of the areas for adjustment, as we thought about strategies and programs, one of the key elements here is extending your program schedule period. In other words, getting out of thinking 6 months ahead, getting so that you're thinking 2 years ahead, 3 years ahead, even four and five, depending upon the size of the particular program, project, exhibition. I mean, a major exhibition in a large institution is typically a four to seven year project in terms of development. As we move smaller in museums in our size of our organization, we often are thinking only 6 months ahead or 5 months ahead on a program or activity, and we just have to get out of that. By attenuating, by stretching out your program schedule, you're able to not give up on a program, but delay it, and gives you more time to do a number of things that actually will improve the program. You'll have more time to think about what its content is, to build relationships with the community, to seek funding that is not just a grant, but perhaps other sources that could be interested. And you are enabling, you're beginning to build your story for when you go out and are explaining how you're addressing the future of your organization. We have, it's just really important to do that. And then rethinking the organization, and that first line is what of Pat was saying about not amputating, but executing a program. In other words, you're not going, if you cut both legs out from under a program, there's not an awful lot left to be able to work on. And we can't be in our efforts, it will actually help us to focus on the funding that we do have on the key programs that we can do, rather than have some just held in abeyance. Staff reassignments will result. Some of them might even be for new positions. When I in Springfield, while I had to cut 60 positions in the first year, I actually reduced with the funding adjustments that I made. I introduced a new position, which was the human resources manager position. In a situation like funding adjustments and cuts, we needed more than ever somebody who was not in the hierarchy that people could go and talk with, someone who was looking at the issue of employment and reemployment and or other adjustments in staff in a way that provided a service that was independent of any department or museum or a library, and really look at the issue of human resources. Further, we looked at consolidations in the organization. We opened up in the input to decision making and channels of communication. It's important, and we'll see this again and again. We need to be talking more with our staffs, not less. We need to be sharing without going into all the details. We need to let them know where we are in the process. And finally, there may be a need and opportunity, although there are limits to this, about the use of volunteers. So,
actually, yes. And Tom and Pat, we have some comments that have come in. Here's one from Ann in Tucson, who said that they've postponed an annual teen program for 1 year, which also allows them to rethink its entire structure. So when they do it again, it's going to be very different.
Exactly the idea. It gives you opportunity rather than a limit.
Here's another comment, and thank you, Ann Woosley. This is a comment from Ann Ackerson in Troy. I've always felt that time can be an ally in program management, particularly when other resources are squeezed.
Yes, I agree. And hello, Ann, from my time in Cooperstown. But that's the whole point. The idea is use the time rather than feeling compressed. You're going to have to make a lot of these decisions very quickly and thoughtfully. You're not going to get all the answers in that time period, but you'll get enough to be able to move ahead. But in your programming, you really can begin to think, I think, more imaginatively by looking out over the longer period of time. You'll introduce flexibility that you didn't think you had.
I would agree with Tom on that. And Akakik Foundation is getting ready to launch a new cooperative agreement with the University of Maryland School of Agriculture, where we'll be the site to give hands-on training to new farmers in sustainable agricultural practices. By dint of this current economic situation, we both have decided to not introduce the program until the fall of 2010. That's been a really good decision because we've been able to really think through the economic impact on us at Akakik of having 12 apprentice farmers, where right now we only have two. And so it's given us more time to think about those issues and address them in our cooperative agreement.
If I may, I have a couple more comments I thought we'd share. And thank you, everyone, for engaging in this conversation. Mary D. in Frankfurt said, interested in the percentage of personnel cost. Ours runs about 68%. This is the whole Department of Parks across the state, so we don't have much choice on what we can cut. I've been hearing this a bit myself, that a real chunk of most people's expenses are their personnel, their
right.
people.
It's really typical of the nonprofit community as a whole that we would see personnel expenses run as high as 80%. And that is about what personnel expenses are at Akakik.
So and that gets at, I think, the next set of slides, which help us to see about what we address and how to make those decisions, those hard decisions, because in a time when we don't have the revenue, we have to look at reductions in staff. And go ahead.
No, please.
So and we have to look with a question mark as to whether these can be replaced by volunteers. We made a very conscious decision, one of our principals for the library, for example, that there were lots of people coming out of the woodwork in the community saying, well, we'll volunteer to keep our branch library open. Well, you can't do that. There's a reason why people get masters in library science, just like masters in fine arts and get experience as a curator. And that is to be able to apply professional decisions.
Yes. Sorry about that.
So organizing your adjustments, because there's so much, because there is, can are you, which slide do you want me to work from?
Oh, whichever one you like. It just took off on its own.
Organizing your major adjustments, again, reflecting that 68%, and what most of you will find is staffing adjustments are going to be the important place where you have to make adjustments. And you'll be doing that in a variety of ways. We are interested in seeing, at some point in the questions, there was actually a question about staffing adjustments. So if we could ask you what you've been dealing with, but as we talk about temporary, the pros and cons of various forms. One is temporary layoffs. The pro of that is it's a good thing if it's short term for staff, but if short term. But the thing that really works against doing temporary layoffs is that it provides, in a weird sort of way, provides too much hope for staff. Because if you're saying to your staff, well, we're going to need to lay you off between now and in October 1, and then we'll be bringing you back on. Well, how do you really know that you're going to, in times like these, you're going to be able to bring them back October 1? Much better that you introduce what you would call a permanent layoff. In other words, you've eliminated that position and you've made some decisions about programming going forward so that you're likely to not have to, you're not going to be continuing with that program for the next 12 months. Now, and it's a hard decision to make, and we'll talk a bit more about that, but by making those kinds of hard choices, now you're going to be improving your ability to be successful going forward. The biggest challenge for permanent layoffs is that you're going to lose a lot of institutional memory. You're going to be losing people who have been around, some of them for 20 or 30 years perhaps, depending upon how your reorganization has gone. Remember, you're not cutting, You're rethinking your organization and your organization structure as to what you need to have going forward based upon the programming decisions you have. You're not making a decision, and you should not make a decision based upon the individual. That's really critical, because you get into a whole host of issues civil rights and making decisions that have nothing to do with performance. You have to think about the positions and organizing in that way. On furloughs, it's very popular now to have furloughs. That's way many organizations. Back 20 years ago, furloughs, because we are at the front end of making adjustments with the government, furloughs was not really a choice for us, but we made a decision that we were not going to use furloughs, a conscious decision, because we felt our employees were already being paid too little, and that by having them do a furlough, we were in effect cutting their salaries. And we felt it was better to make decisions about the number of staff we had and the programs we were offering than to try and keep more people going for a longer period of time and reducing their salaries by 3 or 5 or 10%, depending upon how many days they would be furloughed. Salary freezes, very common, because the cost of living increase and step adjustments are things that you just can't do in these times. It keeps the status quo, but again, the talent may leave on this because they get tired of making the kind of money that they're making. But Pat, you may have a couple of thoughts on that as well.
The salary freeze in the con situation, as we said, the talent may leave the organization. It may not occur in this particular environment, because where you might want to go is also facing the same kind of salary freeze situation that you are. The other thing that we saw in our group this morning was some organizations are also doing benefit freezes, not contributing to the pension plan or not increasing benefits for their staff. And then the salary reduction, it does the same thing that a furlough does, which
right.
I think Tom may have already said that. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
He did, just to repeat.
But we think that, and even now, even compared to 20 years ago, employees and museums in our nonprofits and in most nonprofits are not making the level of compensation that, especially at the lower levels of staff, that are able to be, reduced in any way. Better to keep the people that we have getting paid at the same level and adjust the programs. Now, in terms of operating areas, we have, yes.
We actually did a poll of the audience in response to the question people were wondering about personnel costs,
mm-hmm.
and Pat was exactly right. Most of the groups here are at 60% or above, to the tune of 52, 59, 66% or so of our group, and the rest are below 60%.
Nice. Right. And I would say that the higher the number, most likely a higher percentage, the most likely is you're a smaller organization that is really looking at maintaining a house, maintaining a program, by being there in the house rather than by doing an awful lot of outreach into the community.
You mentioned volunteer programs earlier, Tom. I'm not
yes.
sure if it's something you're going to come back to. But
well,
we
I think
have a
that
question
we need
about
you
that.
Need to make you need to be very sensitive, and the larger the institution, the more you have to be. That replacing people with volunteers is often undercutting the kinds of services that the public has come to be to expect. If you let a group of volunteers run a library for 6 or 12 months, you're not going to be able to find things at the end of that time. The whole process of, well, I think it should go here instead of where it's supposed to go, means that you're going to have a very different arrangement on your shelves if people, in fact, keep up with it. Because a high-volume usage library with a lot of activity, there's an awful lot of work that has to be done. And the staff person needs to be there to supervise everybody, and that's where the real cost is that has to be made in terms of adjustments. It's not the high school student that's coming in and shelving books on the weekend. You almost want to make sure you keep some of those, because those are part of your community connection. So if we look at then the hours, the kind of programmatically, the hours and adjustments that you need to make as a function of reduced staff, Cutting hours is one. We Springfield, we cut half of the time or more in the library. We cut half the time in the museums to about 52% of the hours that they had been open previously. In the libraries, we cut more than that, but with eight facilities, we were able to adjust where we were making the cuts so that, in fact, we were open the same hours, but we were not open in every facility in the same hours the way that we were. Ultimately, though, in our second year, we lost so much money that the next step for us was to actually close branch libraries, which was a very challenging situation. But we did it, and we had to do it. But we had, in doing that, we had done a comprehensive, objective review of all of the facilities, including the Central Library, to see what are the issues about closing them. What is it? What's the volume of circulation? How many reference questions are coming in? How many people are in there just for after-school activity? Is the building itself something that can be renovated for handicapped accessibility if it wasn't already? And 20 years ago, we were just in the front end of that kind of change. And based upon all of those experiences which we weighted, we came up with the decision as to which neighborhood branch libraries we would have to close. Needless to say, those branches weren't happy. But we were fortunate because we involved the city. They knew exactly what we were doing at every step of the way. They knew why we were doing it. They knew how. And eventually, they knew which ones. But we didn't use that politically to try and influence decisions. We knew that we were going to have to make adjustments, and we did it. And we had members of the city and the representative of the mayor on our board. We had ex officio positions, the head of the city council, the chairman of the school committee, all of which were able to participate in these discussions in addition to our board members. So selected programming, again, like we cut out in the library, we cut the bookmobile because we found that on a cost-effective basis compared to, let's say, 20 or 25 years before when bookmobiles were very popular, there weren't, for the cost of running it, there were so few books circulated by the bookmobile that it was better that we just conclude that program. In a museum, it might be, you know, it may be that you would, just by the number of hours you're closed, you may be doing an adjustment in the number of public programs you have or the times of the day you're doing public programs, especially if a program has only three people or five people, and it's the same three to five people every day or every week. Well, maybe it's time to think about how you can reach those three to five people in another way or help them understand why it's important why we don't have a staff person anymore that might be able to do that. Pat, you have any thoughts on this?
Recently I served a 6-month interim directorship for the Sewell Belmont House and Museum, which is the home of the National Woman's Party. Sits right on Capitol Hill next to the Hart Senate Office Building, yet we haven't been able to tap into those federal funds that we'd like to see, and we were probably already reduced down to as far as we could possibly reduce, but we did do some additional adjustments in 2008, and that included shortening our hours, again keeping exhibitions up longer, and on the programming really focusing on group tours because we could handle the group tour better. We could get our docents assigned more efficiently, and we kept our good relationship with the Girl Scouts with our selected programming.
And thinking about this, remember, you want to be visible in your community. You really want to make sure that you have not just gone into a hole, gotten into a cave, and say, well, we'll come out when things are better. Because ultimately, it's your relationship with your community, your funders, your members, your users, all the people who are important to you, are looking to you as the director and senior staff to make some critical decisions because they want to continue working with you. It's really important that you have in the process of making these adjustments, but it's not necessarily all the details. Again, just like for staff, you don't do this in the community, but that you're building a communications program that will communicate and repeat and help people know what the challenges are and know when the challenges are. It goes to the question from Barbara about what, it's an earlier question about how do you control public expectation. And I think that and the way you do that is by effectively using communication in a variety of ways, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
I think the communication is very important, and one of our challenges at Sewell Belmont was the fact that we had not gotten beyond the National Women's Party and gotten beyond our walls. And one of the things I really tried to do, but it was just not possible to make up the lost ground. But I urged the education staff to, once they had an educator back in place, because we didn't have one at the moment, to establish a relationship with one of the public schools on Capitol Hill. We did not have the support of Eleanor Holmes Norton, the D.C. representative, because she didn't see us as part of the community of the city of Washington. And so where we were located, we were always sort of looked upon as if we were just part of the federal system. We were supported in part by the Park Service, so she was never interested in getting us funds from the D.C. government line item in the federal budget. So having had that experience, hopefully they have been able to rectify that and have adopted at least one public school on Capitol Hill.
So I'd like to have us get answers to some other questions that we have, if you don't mind. And they will go to answer, I think, Barbara's about rental of museum space as we proceed. What's funding, first of all, in what ways have you managed staff expenses? How have you done it so far? We'd like to know what it is that you've been doing that are along the lines of what we have been describing. It would be very interesting to see the challenges that you are dealing with and how you're doing it to this point. And this is kind of fun to see this, mm-hmm. your what you're doing.
Yeah.
Well, fun in a technical
yeah,
way.
Yeah, right. The process is fun. We know that the agony, yeah, right. there's no ecstasy in this agony.
Right.
Just making sure everyone.
We're not here with whips and chains. Here. So
having done four layoffs, I've sometimes felt that way.
So, and it's really hard, and we'll talk a little bit about that if we have time towards the end of our adjustment. Well, it seems like most people have done salary freezes, and some of you have done furloughs. It would be interesting to know if those of you who have done furloughs are in public agencies as opposed to private. And if you, but that's, we don't have to get into that. Let's get to another question here, and that is, what funding sources have decreased in your institution? That's our poll question three. Because I think that's starting to get to some of the other, that helps explain some of the things we're dealing with, and we'll be getting into some of those questions, some of those areas. And it tells us a lot about mm-hmm. the personality of your challenges. Mm-hmm.
I've also brought up that picture of the poll results you did from your session earlier today, so
yes.
We can just compare it to the audience here in Indianapolis. By the way, I just wanted to point out, while we're looking at these results and people are scanning through to vote, there was idea of using your historic site to rent it out for events and so forth, and Mary D. followed that up by saying, the paranormal people love our historic homes and battlefields, and it's good income. We don't run the program, but we do get the admission, and it's $35 an hour for them.
The paranormal people?
I guess there are people who like their historic homes because of the haunted house kind of stuff.
Okay.
I think, and Mary D. will clarify if I got that wrong, but
well,
that's my sense.
Well, that can go into the line of creative programming.
Yes.
Right.
So there are also some fun things to do. Well, no, that's not in the context of this. This
right,
is too
right,
painful.
Right.
I won't go into the...
Right.
And I think that as we look at... And I see that most of you are dealing with the issue of public funding. And this is really pretty consistent with what we saw today. I think a little bit more on in public funding than we had this morning. Mm-hmm. Pat, you were pointing
and
to...
And also, I would see more in membership loss than we saw this morning,
yes.
If I'm right.
Yes.
And looking at that, and that's, I would like to know a little bit more about that as well, but may come out in our conversations. Just getting back to the wedding reception question, we're considering doing this at Accokeek for exactly the same reason you're doing it, and that is a huge moneymaker for Sewell Belmont. We happen to have an extremely nice garden. We have a permanent tent that goes up in March and stays up to the end of October. We don't have room inside the house to do weddings, but we do them in the garden. And other than providing the tent, everything else has to be done by a wedding planner or the wedding party itself. We don't get into the business of planning weddings. We just get into the business of collecting the money. And for us, it's a $155,000 a year business. I want to get into it at Accokeek. I'm getting some staff pushback. But I think it would be a really fairly quick form of earned revenue for us.
So, and then I think the other question that would be good to hear now is how have you adjusted your programs and services as a result of funding reductions? And this is, again, implicit in this is you've made some decisions about staffing levels because of the dollars involved. But now you're getting to the issue of what are the programming changes that you're having to do that reflect the lower level of funding that you get. And this then goes to a subsequent question, we'll get to the issue of earned income. Increased admissions is one form of earned income. And there will be others that we will be looking at. So I think this is a really interesting, maybe we can come back to that so that we can proceed with the slides a bit.
You bet. And by the way, if you think of other things, and we didn't list everything, and you're doing some other things that we should know about, go ahead and let us know in the chat, too.
Right. We are reading what you're sending. Now, other ways of to respond, possibilities of responding that you've done and or have you could be thinking about is sale of non-collection assets. In other words, you may, and if you haven't done it this time, as you go into a second or third year, you may be looking at assets which are not being used, and that can generate some current income. Land, buildings, or other kinds of things. The other could be, let's say, a boat. If you have a boat for some reason and it's not part of the collection and you're not using it in any significant way, perhaps that's something which the program can be delayed and you could sell that boat and in fact make some money from it. Or it's a reproduction of something that is might be appealing, but it's not a part of the collection. Then there's the issue of deaccessioning and selling objects in the collections. That's a pretty touchy issue, but we'd like to hear from you if you are doing that. One that we've talked about a good bit this morning was the notion of setting up or increasing a line of credit. For those of you who may be less familiar with that, the line of credit is a line at a bank, your financial institution, that you can borrow from, that they've guaranteed you can borrow from. And it's often used in those of our institutions where there is a highly cyclical business, like a very strong summer or winter program, and then you need to make sure that you're keeping staff going through the other season, so you'll get based upon past experience, you'll get more revenue. It could be just to meet the timing of public funding as it comes in. That's the use of the line of credit. If you're using it to just keep your programs going, that's a really dangerous thing, because funders are going to look, particularly independent funders, corporations and more so foundations, are really going to look hard, or maybe even for some federal grants, they're going to look hard if they're seeing your line of credit, what you've borrowed on that line of credit is an increase. One of the things we didn't talk about here, that some organizations actually have, and we learned this morning, actually have reserve funds. You could call them rainy day funds. It might be a cash reserve, whatever it might be, that could in fact be some money that you could use to help support projects or programs in the near term. But again, cash reserves are they're kind of an alternative to not having a line of credit. You may not have to pay any interest on them directly, but you may want to charge interest on it because you know there's a cost of losing those.
We set up a line of credit at Accokeek Foundation for the first time this year. We have a reserve fund. We have full operating year of in our reserve. So we have full operations at a level of $750,000 in reserve. The line of credit we set up against our bond fund. And the reason we did it was because our National Park Service appropriation, every year for the last 5 years, they've been later and later and later in paying us, meaning that we've had to use more of our own cash until we get reimbursed now by the National Park Service. Typically, we would get our money in as late as May. This year, it was July 12th. So that was a real important step for us to set up that line of credit. We have protected our reserve fund. And our reserve, we will protect our reserve. We also have a rainy day fund. And for 2010, we will draw on the rainy day fund. The next one here Tom has is changing the endowment payout formula. Traditionally, you expect to do a 5% drawdown on your endowment earnings and trying to keep your endowment whole. That's why the 5% rule is established by most organizations. But it's not mandated, and you can change the payout, and we have done that as well at Accokeek. We had a very strange payout situation that I won't try to explain to you, but I will say we've gone away from 5-year rolling average to an 8-year rolling average with a cap. We can't take any more than a higher amount of from 120, which is our current base. We can take $20,000 more or $20,000 less, but that's the parameters within which we're working. But talk more about endowment, Tom.
Sure. And, you know, a payout, for those of you who may not be involved with endowment, it's if you have a million-dollar endowment, a payout typically would be something like 5% or in the range of 4 to 6%. That makes sure that you are only taking a certain amount out of your endowment each year, much like interest you earned on your investment. If you are appreciating in value, your stocks are going up and your bonds are maybe going up, you might go to $1,200,000, in which case 5% would give you another $10,000 that you would be available. In these times, instead of $1,000,000, you may have $600,000, which means that instead of having $50,000, you would now have $30,000. It's a very helpful and important tool. We would caution you about doing more than that. Some institutions are in fact borrowing from their endowment, and we think that's a dangerous thing. We get back to the notion of you need to make decisions. You need to not forestall those decisions. To forego those decisions for a better time, because this is going to keep on going for the next 2 to 3 years. I think we should keep going in the interest of time.
Yeah, actually, and your next point about consolidating operations has already generated a fair number of ideas and examples. You've got things like Connie, who says that they're consolidating collection storage space in order to save rental fees. You have Carol in Harrisonville, who says our historical society and library are looking for ways to consolidate their overlapping activities and services. Also, Anne Ackerson made some comments as well on this point, and Mary Warner says was also talking about your deaccessioning and sale of some objects in the collection. So there's some really interesting ideas going on here.
Yes.
But I wanted to point out Connie's note that they're aggressively pursuing partnerships with local organizations to assume responsibility for day-to-day management of sites and museums entrusted to their care.
Yeah, that's really excellent to see that going on. It's something we've suggested for years, and now we're finally getting to it because we're desperate. But it's really something we probably need to do going forward.
Right.
Outsourcing of staff to other organizations for a fee is something that Accokeek has done in the past, and we're considering doing it in the future. Our chief financial officer is actually a certified public accountant who only works for us for about 30 hours a month, but is willing to be outsourced from us to others, and we get part of that fee that she would be paid, because we've done that in the past. We're thinking about doing some of the same thing with some of our farm staff, because right next door to us is the Hard Bargain Farm. And so we really need to cooperate and collaborate with them.
And then one more last comment on the consolidation. We are talking about and consolidating, not a merger at this point. We're talking about institutions coming together, let's say the directors of the five historic houses in a community or the cultural organizations in a community, to say, gee, can we pool our maintenance staff so that we can shave, that the maintenance staff can work across the four or five institutions, because they're essentially doing the same thing in all of their institutions, right? That kind of thing.
I mean, imagine printed publications, for those doing that, going to a neighboring institution and let's say, look, we have a similar exhibition coming up, or there's a thematic connection, let's go ahead and do some shared print collateral if
right.
we're doing that.
We're not against merger. I think that I'm also not suggesting that. It's just that we know from watching other institutions that mergers are very difficult. They take a lot more time than people would think, and you can't really rush through it in a 6-week or 8-week time frame. That's a year-long thing. And the issues that are going to come up, frankly, are going to be more issues. There's never a merger of equals. Somebody's going to be on the top and somebody's on the bottom, and that ultimately becomes an issue of boards and who's going to be in charge of the institution when it remains and who's going to leave.
And we've seen mergers like the San Antonio Museums Group come together, stayed together for 10 years, and then split apart.
Right.
So never really took. Hmm. And it was really an expensive, hard lesson.
And an advantage we had in Springfield was that the museums and the library were always part of the same single nonprofit institution. Now, they grew so they were acting like they were five different institutions. But one of my tasks before this was happening was to bring them into what I call a federated organization, or a federal government for the organization, rather than a series of independent agencies. So let's go to the next, because we're running out of time. Implementation. After you've made these decisions, the key elements of implementation for this are moving ahead quickly. And that you have to make the decisions in a tight time frame, most likely, and then you have to implement, and you have to move ahead positively. You can't be looking back at woe is me, look at all the things we've lost. You have to come out and articulate. This goes back to the managing expectations, as to looking at what you are doing moving ahead. And we regret that we have to reduce staff to be in the context of the time, but we are moving ahead to in response to, and because we know of the interests of the public that we've gained through our boards, through talking with our visitors and our users, and a variety of other ways, that these are the most used programs that we have. The other piece about this is when it goes very specifically to personnel. Once you've made a decision about adjustments in personnel and reductions in staff, you need to do it. You need to do it all at once. You need to have them, even. And it sounds cold and crass, but you need to reduce them. You need to help escort them out of the building. They can come back in a day or two and get their things, but you need to move them out, because it is so traumatic that it really can say, if you let this go even a day or two, the negativity among the staff who know they are going is so great that it will dismantle any positive effort that you are making. You really need to be it's a very tough, emotionally difficult action, but it really is the best way to go. Everybody will benefit. What we did then in Springfield is that we then organized, because for our 38 employees that we had laid off, we then organized resume assistance done by our staff, our senior staff, assistance in writing or refining their resumes, looking at their skills, helping them in making contacts. We also sent out a letter to employee and similar organizations in the region, to saying how good staff we had. Through our efforts and theirs, we were able to reemploy all but one of the 38 people we had laid off in 2 months. And that saved $150,000 in unemployment compensation, which we had to budget in our budget because nobody else was going to pay for their unemployment compensation. So by being proactive in the interest of the employees laid off as well as those who remain, you can actually be helping your organization. Then all of this going, and then the changes in operations that result require more managing time. They're serious disruption, they're traumatic, and you need to really work carefully and closely because you can't anticipate all of the change, what you have to do in all of the changes. You have to be listening, looking, and working closely with your staff and your department heads and your managers to make sure that they're responding and not putting aside the issues that are coming up. Then in marketing, and I look at marketing as the total experience, including public relations, not something that's truly separate from public relations, that you emphasize the public relations side, which is free. That is story placement. That is use of the internet these days, for the most part, getting emails out, communications with members and donors, with your public agencies, with the leadership, that this is what you're doing. Not this is what we don't have anymore. The whole concept of value is one that is critical to understand. In the stock, the value of a price of a share of stock is based upon a company's history and what it's accomplished, its current performance, and its prospects for the future. The exact same thing is what people look at for a nonprofit. What is the history and record of accomplishment? How are we performing in the near term? Not just in a dollar and cent standpoint, but how good are the programs and how are we delivering programs and services to our audiences and community? And then what are you going to do in the future? Where are you going? That's what people don't like to give to fill a hole. They like to give because they're involved in the future. By having a forward-looking program, by cutting through rather than cutting back, and then looking ahead and articulating this in a positive way, you can really move forward. And it's not easy. It's really not easy, but it can be done and successfully to begin to shape your future.
I think one of the important things we've continued to do at ACACEC is formal cooperative agreements with other organizations. We have one with the new National Children's Museum. They've written a play that's been presented on our site with our museum theater people. These take some time, but they put us in a better position of being more well-known to the general public. Our location is at the end of a dirt road. Well, it's not a dirt road, but it's a dead-end road. And so getting partnerships going with that kind of an organization, with Little Friends for Peace, which is a peace teaching group for young children at risk, has allowed us to have a greater presence in the community. And the community presence will help us raise money as we go forward.
And Sandy Denninger made a point about community presence being so important, but there's pressure from others at the organization that it's taking time away from things that might be considered more direct chances of getting immediate revenue, like writing grants and planning for more programs that have admission. And of course, with a staff of two, it's very difficult. And earlier, Anne Ackerson made a note, too, about the sale of assets and mergers do, in fact, can take some time and might not be seen as immediate remedies to the situation. So we're hearing this coming up consistently.
I think the idea of having all these arrows in your quiver, as Anne put it, is the right way to think about them, but you want to figure out when you're going to deploy them. The other thing I think is, you know, the most important standard we meet as institutions is, how are we relevant to our audience? And we have to continue to think about relevance to our audience. What we have done with like grant makers is we have such good relationships with our grant makers that we simply called them up and talked to them about what they were facing. And we know that some of the people that we can typically depend on, their endowments drop so much that they're not going to support anybody, or they're going to take one organization and fully support it. Once we knew that we could put them on the back burner. We'd keep them informed programmatically of what we're doing, but we're not spending time writing a grant to somebody who doesn't have the money to give it to us.
Similarly, grant writing is something in almost every instance, certainly in 80 to 90% of the instances, it's a much longer lead time than you have. What you need to be looking at is how you relate to individuals and your present donors and your members. They're the people that may come in with additional support. And I see some of the comments about it, but I'm only one or two people. It's at points like this that you really have to turn to your board, and then that's the challenge as well as the opportunity. Your board, just like maybe your organization, wasn't ready, wasn't thinking about this. But you need to now think about how you use your board, and maybe it's the time to introduce changes. And slowly, not to try and do a revolution at the board level, but to engage your board and have them know, because you've been communicating with them clearly through the process, that they indeed have to now help in the communication going out, that indeed they are the front line of community relations. And it's the, you talked about this, the superiors. Well, if the superiors are the director, executive director, deputy director, assistant director, they're the people that really should be out in the community. And then the senior, the staff below that are people who really can be best at delivering the public service in the facility or on the ground, if you will. It's really tricky to be able to do this, but it's important to do it this way. And then when you're doing your fundraising, and that is beginning immediately, as I say here, it's a commitment to mission, program, and service. And you focus on those individuals, because individual giving is the broadest base. You know these real people. They have the most invested in their own desires for service that they can, and continuing the organization. But then that is you then looking at who's surfacing as being great for a potential board member. How can we change the mix on the board? Maybe it's time to retire some folks who just don't have the capacity, and they've been there because they've always been there. So we go to, and then following these implementations elements, again, reiterating all those previous 10 slides or 12 slides, you're going through, and then you've implemented your year, and you immediately, or let's say you take a weekend, or you have a glass of wine or two, and the next day you say, okay, now I'm implementing this, or you maybe even take a month, but you have to begin saying, what are my next round of adjustments, and outlining them. So you're not caught off guard with 5 weeks or 6 weeks to do it. You could begin thinking about these issues, revisiting your change, seeing how the decisions you made are working, and monitoring them, and so that you can make further adjustments, but always moving ahead positively. If we look then beyond what we are dealing with in terms of our operations, you need to be looking at these elements. And we've talked about, they've come up throughout the conversation, and the great participation that you all have had has been wonderful. But extending your reach, not simply cutting back, but how can you be even more of a presence? In Springfield, I realized that I was going to be, that the Library and Museums Association, thanks to bankruptcies of some companies that were downtown in Springfield, Library and Museums Association was going to be the largest business in downtown Springfield in some ways. So I increased the role I was playing in economic development and marketing the community, and actually began thinking about and exercising more of a leadership role of attracting other kinds of resources to Springfield. That's an example of extending reach. I could do it as the president of the institution. In smaller institutions, it may be the director, but it's certainly somebody working with board members. Similarly, cooperative agreements, like we've talked about, consolidating operations, and truly considering mergers, and I've seen that some of these are really found that it's a good thing, and it's really finding the different kinds of partnerships that we deal with, because you can find a whole host of new partnerships in this that you find tied to your programs and services. Increasing the presence in the activity of your community. If you've not been doing this already, you really need to take steps to help yourself listen and get input from the community, because they're going to be the vocal front line. If you have to do advocacy at City Hall or at the state level
or even at the federal level, but certainly advocacy at City Hall or state level, your citizens are going to be the ones that, not your managers, not even your board, are going to be the ones that need to be heard in volume. Your board members, or possibly you, can make the can be on the political inroad side, but your citizens need to be the front line of talking. And then you need to build new constituencies. So I think with that, we've covered our essential points, and there may be other questions that you would have.
Well, there's some really interesting threads that have picked up on your idea of looking for some unique community partnerships, and one in particular involves relating to community colleges local schools. In fact, I love this idea from I think it was from Heidi. She said, we tap into colleges for other services like marketing classes, PR classes, graphic design classes. People are looking for not just internships but class projects to take on some of these activities. So I think that's a fantastic idea. Carmen says that she works at a university where they're always looking to partner with community organizations. So there are innovative, interesting,
yes,
and willing partners waiting.
There's no one answer. There's no one solution, and your solution is your own. This is not a cookie cutter thing. It's very individualized, and it's very powerful as a result. And we will look forward. You can contact us. We are glad to hear your thoughts, and we then will share others as we get them. I'm glad to continue this conversation on an email with our cultural.resources.management@gmail.com. As a place to build a clearinghouse of other activities.
Great.
And things that are going on. And we thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and thanks for making yourself available. We, of course, will have the recording, the related slides, and the related discussion area. So I hope people will continue to share some of the ways they're dealing with this and solicit help from others. And thanks for those who continue to share their stories in the discussion area. So please join me in thanking Tom and Pat. And I've also put a link to a feedback form. We'd love to get your feeling as to what was most valuable during this session. And that'll launch in a new window, so don't be alarmed by it. In just a couple of moments, my colleague John will join us, and we'll do a brief happy hour. It won't necessarily last a whole hour, so we know it's Friday, and some of you would like to find actual libations or other things that await families and friends, and just a new setting after 2 days of joining us online. So wrap up with you in just a few minutes, so stay tuned at 4:30 Eastern. We'll be back for a few minutes of happy hour and wrap up. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, and it was great to talk with you and get all your comments.